assisted Orton's mother, who was delivered by Oklahoma City's first black physician. Growing up, Orton read Looper's memoir, Behold the Walls, multiple times, and he once actually got to shake her hand at the Oklahoma State Fair, where Looper ran a stand that sold catfish and fried green tomatoes. Orton still referred to her, with polite reverence, as Miss Looper. Despite this history, Orton told me that he had always felt awkwardly pinned between the black and white worlds of Oklahoma City. He grew up in a world he describes as a bubble, the middle-class suburbs, way up north, in an area dominated by white professionals. Although he played a sport that, even in a predominantly white city, was dominated by black players, he played that sport for a white high school. Orton went to the same high school his brother did, Bishop McGinnis, a private Catholic school known for excellence in sports. Orton's brother won 3 state basketball championships there, so naturally Orton was determined to win 4. His first chance came during his freshman year, in 2006, when Bishop McGinnis met Douglas in the championship. The matchup was sociologically loaded. Douglas was the most important school in the history of Oklahoma City's East Side. It was as much a community headquarters as a traditional school. Ralph Ellison played running back for the Douglas football team and trumpet for the Douglas marching band. At halftime, he would scramble out of one uniform and into the other. The jazz legend Charlie Christian built experimental guitars out of cigar boxes on the desks of Douglas classrooms, then played them at night in deep deuce. Bishop McGinnis, by contrast, was a rich, private Catholic school whose student body, Orton said, was 98% white, if not 99. I asked him how that affected him as a young black man who hadn't grown up on the East Side. If you go to Bishop McGinnis, he said, you're considered white, basically. The 2006 championship game was held on the state fairgrounds, in a place that everyone called the Big House, but was officially the Jim Norrick Arena. Douglas and McGinnis were evenly matched, and the game went back and forth, then to overtime, and then back and forth in overtime. In the last few seconds, McGinnis found itself trailing by 1. Orton got the ball and drove toward the hoop. This is when the trouble began. Before Orton could score, the Douglas defense hammered him. Foul. He would have to decide the season with free throws, the weakest part of his game. Orton insists, to this day, that he would have made both shots, but no one else in the arena could have shared that confidence. The point, however, is moot. As Orton walked toward the foul line, it was pointed out that his leg was bleeding. The rules on this were clear. Orton would have to leave the game immediately and remain on the sidelines until the bleeding could be stopped. It was a reprieve. His coach replaced him with a player who happened to be the opposite of Orton in every obvious way. A short, white, sparingly used free throw expert. He came in and made both of Orton's free throws, putting Bishop McGinnis up by 1 with 7 seconds left. Orton's bleeding, meanwhile, had been stopped, so the coach pulled the free throw expert out and put Orton back in. Douglas ran a play for its best shooter, who got free and rose for what would have been the championship-winning shot, until Orton flew over, stretched out to his full length, and got his fingertips on the ball. Block. Time expired. Bishop McGinnis won. It was Orton's 8th block of the game, a play no one else on the floor could have made, certainly not the small, white, free-throw expert. The McGinnis crowd exploded in ecstasy. The Douglas crowd exploded in rage. There were accusations of chicanery, questions of procedure, controversy over whether or not a formerly bleeding player can legally re-enter a game before any time has elapsed from the game clock. Injustice. Racial opportunism. Someone threw a bottle at Orton out on the floor. Orton's team walked to the bus escorted by police officers. For the rest of Orton's high school career, he said, Douglas fans went to his games and rooted against him. Game 16, Civil War. James Harden returned to Oklahoma City in an enemy uniform almost exactly 1 month after he had left, November 28, 2012. This happened to be the 128th anniversary of the death of David Payne, leader of the Boomers, when he collapsed into his breakfast after giving the greatest speech of his life. Yet another historical anniversary that was not officially acknowledged in the arena. Harden's performance during his month away had been a recurrent waking nightmare for Thunder fans. He had morphed instantly from a bench player into a superstar, winning Western Conference Player of the Week after the season's first few games. The debate over whether Harden deserved a max contract, hotly contested in many circles only a month before, now seemed ridiculous. He was destroying, day by day, all of the arguments Thunder fans had used to talk themselves into the trade. Apparently, Harden had been sacrificing more talent in OKC than anyone realized. Plenty of subtleties had gone into the decision to trade him, of course. Need, chemistry, taxes, the future. But none of that made up for this sickening central fact. The Thunder had had this player on their team. They'd had a way to keep him, and they had chosen to let him go. Sam Presti's process demanded patience, a long-term perspective. But that was hard to muster, day by day by day by day, as Harden poured in points and stole all the highlight reels and made mediocre Houston look like a rising power. This was the state of things at the end of November when James Harden came back to Oklahoma City. The only redeeming fact for the Thunder was that they, too, were playing well. In some ways, better than they had with Harden. Despite that last-second loss to the Spurs on opening night, the team was now 11-4. They were beginning to look like the imminent champions everyone had expected before the trade. Two nights before Harden's return, OKC had demoralized the lowly Charlotte Bobcats, winning by 45 points. The superstars were dominating, as usual, in their very different styles, wild Westbrook and precise Durant, and the role players were filling their roles admirably. No one knew how the Oklahoma City crowd would respond to Harden's return. Even the individual fans walking into the arena couldn't know how they would act in the aggregate. What was the appropriate response? Applause for the good times? Boos for the betrayal? Something in between? Should they shower the floor with fake beards, limp, shaggy emblems of the city's ruined innocence? Should they chant, in unison, sarcastically, Harden's old media quotes about brotherhood and sacrifice and the coming Thunder dynasty? Should everyone just bury their heads in their hands and weep? How resilient was Oklahoma City? How far did its niceness extend? Fans entered the arena carrying anti-Harden signs. Spear the beard. Hey, Harden, you may have your $80 million, but I bet you'll never win a ring. The Thunder's most colorful regular fan was a rotund 25-year-old who went by the alter ego Thundor. He stood shirtless in the crowd, just behind the basket, wearing suspenders and a Mexican wrestling mask, shaking his naked belly and shouting at opponents through a megaphone. That night, he had painted an $80 million bill on his stomach, in reference to Harden's rocket salary. $80 million bills do not exist except on the belly of Thundor. He held a sign that said, "Fear the greed, not the beard." Before the game, Harden was introduced by the arena's announcer with a complete lack of ceremony. His voice was quick and flat, his words blurred together. Starting at guard 6'5 from Arizona State, number 13, James Harden. It was as if he were trying to sneak the announcement past 18,000 people. But the crowd had already come to its feet. This was the official moment of response. A warm cheer blew through the arena. There were a few boos here and there, but these were swept away by the ovation. Louder and longer applause than anyone had any right to expect. After Harden's abandonment of Oklahoma, after his success in, of all places, Texas, Oklahoma City was still, despite the mocking homemade signs and the jiggling belly of Thundor, still, in the aggregate, nice. The doubters all were stunned. Then there was a professional basketball game. Both teams had spent the previous 2 days downplaying this game to the media. It was just another game, they insisted. One of 82, nobody cared, nothing special, no grudges. Why were people even talking about it? It was a game, not a civil war. When the ball went up for tip-off, however, what followed looked exactly like a civil war. The Thunder came out to destroy James Harden, not only to beat him, but to embarrass him. Serge Ibaka blocked the Rockets' first shot, then dunked the Thunder's first basket. A minute later, he blocked another shot, then dunked again. When Harden slithered through the defense for a layup, Serge Ibaka rose and swatted it away. This was how the entire night went. Everyone on the Thunder took turns stealing the ball from Harden and blocking his shots. Whenever Harden thought he had an opening, a Thunder player would invariably come sprinting from behind to spike the ball out of bounds. Even Hashim Thabeet, the awkward backup center, blocked two Harden layups on a single play. In the third quarter, Harden stared across the court at Kevin Martin, the player who had taken his place in OKC, and seemed to fall into a reverie. How did that guy end up in my place? Is he going to be better at that role than I was? Did I make a mistake? While Martin passed the ball to Kevin Durant, the man Harden was supposed to be guarding, who was now wide open at the three-point line. Harden realized what was happening too late, lunging out just in time to slap at Durant's arm after he had already released the ball. Durant made both the three-pointer and the ensuing free throw. It was, in short, a nightmare for Harden. At one point, he stole the ball from Westbrook and raced down the floor to drop in a fast-break layup over Durant, but Ibaka came sprinting from behind and swatted it to the floor. Then Ibaka blocked one of Harden's teammates' dunks and made a jump shot of his own. Harden couldn't make a shot, and Ibaka couldn't miss. Late in the game, Ibaka even made a three-pointer. He was playing like the perfect third star, supplementing the other two, without getting in the way, freeing them up to do what they did best. He was doing what Harden had refused to stay and do. The Oklahoma City crowd fused into one solid joy throb. This game was exactly the affirmation they needed. Their team was legitimately great, even in the absence of Harden, and Harden, despite the recent month of evidence, wasn't actually so great after all, not against a team like this. Sam Presti was still a genius. In fact, he had probably somehow engineered all of this as a test for the people of OKC, and although maybe they had doubted him a little, now they would never doubt him again. It was only one game, yes, but what was a season but a bunch of individual games? What was glory but a constellation of individual glories? Harden, the NBA's leading scorer, did not make a single field goal in the first half. His first successful shot came on a layup in the third quarter that the reporter Sam Amick suggested might actually have been a gift from Ibaka, who looked like he could have blocked it, but perhaps felt sorry for his old teammate and didn't. At the end of the night, Ibaka blocked Harden's final attempt at a layup. He had made three shots and missed 13. He had three assists, but also three turnovers. It was the definition of inefficiency. Durant, meanwhile, finished with 37 points, and Harden's replacement, Kevin Martin, added an extremely efficient 17. Ibaka was absurdly effective, with 6 blocks and 11 baskets in only 13 attempts. The loss gave the Rockets a losing record. The Thunder improved to 12-4 and were in the midst of what would become a 12-game winning streak. It was, by far, Harden's worst game of the season. Black Friday. By the end of his career, Stanley Draper had achieved almost all of his grandest goals for Oklahoma City. He had streamlined downtown and radically expanded the city's borders. He had lured industries that would secure the region's future and solved long-standing water problems. And yet, there was one great dream that he had yet to realize. Stanley Draper wanted to build a mountain in downtown Oklahoma City. A mountain, if you thought about it, just made sense. It was really the only thing missing. It would give Oklahoma City, retroactively, a geological reason to exist. All over the world, great cities clustered around and on top of mountains. Here in the Great Plains, however, the Earth had clearly made a mistake, and now Draper was going to fix it, to do the work that deep time had neglected. And the best part was that you wouldn't have to wait for a volcano to erupt or tectonic plates to crash. This would be an instant mountain, scraped into existence with gas-powered tractors, the same kind of heavy machinery Draper had used for his rerun decades before. The mountain would be 300 or 400 feet tall, nearly as tall as the city's tallest skyscrapers. It would rise right next to the freeway. The road to the top would be lined with azaleas, because Stanley Draper loved azaleas. That Draper did not get to build his outlandish mountain is a mark of the decline of his influence near the end of his career. That he conceived of it at all, however, is a mark of how absolute his power had been at its height. In the 1960s, in gratitude for all he had done, Oklahoma City showered Draper with honors. The reservoir 15 miles south of the city, enough water for all the new residents he had made room for, was named Lake Stanley Draper. The Oklahoma House of Representatives passed a resolution officially granting Draper the title Mr. Oklahoma City. A bronze statue of Draper was unveiled next to City Hall. It stood 9 feet tall and depicted him wearing a trench coat, pointing to the sky, holding a half-rolled map of the city. The statue's pedestal was etched with a stanza of free verse Booster Beat poetry. He dreamed impossible dreams, then inspired and united all who could make them probable. He strengthened our stakes, lengthened our cords, and the dreams soared to reality. His was the spirit of Oklahoma City. Look around you. What you see today was his tomorrow, yesterday. On the 78th anniversary of the land run, April 22nd, 1967, 650 people showed up to honor Stanley Draper at a black tie gala in the Persian Room of the Skirvin Hotel. An oil painting was unveiled, and Draper was presented with a sterling silver statue of the Goddess of Achievement. The governor called him the OK in Oklahoma. The symphony orchestra played, and at one point Draper took the baton and conducted it himself. There were multiple standing ovations. Draper had spent so many years bullying these people, and yet now he wept. The business community had pooled its money for a retirement fund that would allow the Drapers to live comfortably for the rest of their lives. No gift was too great for the man who had harnessed OKC's essential chaos and turned it into a proper city. The most fitting tribute to Stanley Draper, however, was physical, a new road. The Stanley Draper Expressway was an elevated highway that rose right over the center of downtown, a marvel of engineering, 50 feet high and nearly 2 miles long, the longest bridge in the state. It cost $13 million. Although the Stanley Draper Expressway had required the nearly complete destruction of Sandtown, the city's oldest black neighborhood, it seemed worth it to the city planners. Oklahoma City was now linked to Interstate 40, a brand new torrent of cars that flowed clear across the country, from North Carolina to California, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The road was the perfect symbol of Draper's career, the ultimate victory over downtown congestion. It would carry 60,000 vehicles a day, a perpetual gray roar like an automotive wind. All the compromises and inefficiencies and confusions of the land run could now be avoided on this monument to the man who had made modern OKC possible. At the dedication ceremony, Draper planted a tree, and then he led a motorcade of antique cars and fire trucks up onto his namesake highway. Not everyone was sad to see Stanley Draper retire. Mayor Norick, then in his second term, was quietly relieved. Draper had been allowed to wield far too much power for far too long, and his ideas had become increasingly eccentric. "I say this with no discredit to Mr. Draper," Norick said, clearly intending discredit. "But I think he needs to rest." Besides, Norick had bigger problems. In 1969, the city's garbage workers went on strike, and, to Norick's annoyance, it had become an issue of race. Norick had a history of strike busting. The Norick and Gaylord families had once bonded by working together to break a printer's strike. But now the garbage workers had brought in, as their representative, Clara Looper. As Stanley Draper's influence had declined throughout the 1960s, Clara Looper's had increased. After the integration of the city's restaurants in 1964, she did not stop organizing. The next year, she led a march against the Oklahoma City police chief, and then a march of 300 people through freezing wind up to Whitetown in the Northwest, right to Mayor Norick's house, followed by a series of night marches through other privileged neighborhoods, Nichols Hills, the Village, Capitol Hill, downtown. Looper once led a 100-mile march from Oklahoma City to Lawton, during which marchers slept on rocks in the Wichita Mountains and on the ground at a gas station, harassed by stray dogs. Garbage collection got right to the heart of the city's institutional racism. It was one of the few jobs the city would hire its black citizens to do. 85% of OKC's sanitation workers were black. And yet, for decades, promotions and pay raises went almost exclusively to whites. Asking nicely had changed nothing. And so the workers came to Looper. And, after she took some useless meetings with officials and got into a shouting match with the city manager, they decided to take action. The strike began on August 19th, 1969, the 11-year anniversary of the first sit-in at Katz, and exactly 50 years to the day since Stanley Draper arrived in Oklahoma City. Looper and the workers marched to City Hall, then to the police station. With Norick's support, the city manager, Robert Oldland, fired all of them. Garbage began to pile up in huge mounds on the sunny streets. It was so hot that the newspaper's weather map showed only a little man sweating, mopping his brow with a handkerchief. The city started to stink. Violence simmered in the background. Martin Luther King Jr., Clara Looper's hero, had been killed the previous spring during a garbage strike in Memphis. When Oklahoma City hired scab workers to drive its trucks, Looper and the strikers lay down on the road in front of them. The garbage strike culminated on Halloween with a demonstration that everyone referred to as Black Friday. Norick had warned Looper not to do it, threatening to block off downtown and arrest anyone who approached, to which Looper responded, characteristically, "No little short, bow-tie-wearing mayor is going to destroy the U.S. Constitution." At noon, a crowd of either 1,500, according to the police, or 10,000, according to Looper, assembled on the east side and began to march toward City Hall. They carried signs, "Black and Proud," "Norick and Oldland Can't Jail Us All," and simply, "Black Friday." Downtown went on lockdown. All the stores closed ahead of the advancing crowd. Armed police officers stood on the tops of buildings, and hundreds more stood in the streets wearing riot helmets with shotguns, clubs, and tear gas. Norick waited on Main Street with a blockade of state troopers. As the marchers approached, they were greeted by a loudspeaker. "Anybody who doesn't want to be arrested, stay back." It is hard to say for sure what happened next. The Oklahoman's account was blunt. Police met the marchers, and after a brief hesitation, they were allowed to continue to City Hall. The version in Clara Looper's memoir is, naturally, much more colorful, and although it is absurd, it has the ring of truth. Stopped by the blockade and ordered to return to the east side, Looper responded with improvisational nonsense. "Umbo, umbo, umbo, umber," she said. "Quis umbo, 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 umber. Ochi, ochio, oku, okro, okmu. Sho, awan, hu, chakan, chun. Mung, ming, o, umbo, umbo." The policemen were stunned. The blockade parted. The march was allowed to continue. "You have just seen a miracle," shouted the Reverend W.K. Jackson in his mighty frog voice, and the marchers all sang, "We shall overcome," and soon they reached City Hall, where, as city council members peeked out the windows, Looper gave a triumphant speech. Not long after this, the city worked out a deal with the sanitation workers, and the strike came to an end. This was a disappointment to Stanley Draper, who had hoped that the city might be able to use all of the many tons of uncollected garbage to begin to build his artificial mountain. Part 4. Distance. All the sacrifices that have helped bring the city into existence come to nothing if the life that the city makes possible is not its own reward. Lewis Mumford, The City in History. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team fucking here. Drake. Terror is truth, and truth is terror, and it never ends. John Edgar Wideman, Writing to Save a Life. The grandest street this generation has ever seen. By 2012, local drivers were terrified of the Stanley Draper Expressway. It was visibly crumbling. Large pieces of the road's surface, coffee table-sized chunks of concrete, as the Oklahoman evocatively put it, routinely fell right out of it, leaving holes that stopped traffic. Nearly 50 years of constant punishment had reduced its surface to a quilt of patches. The sections were loosely joined, and water leaked through, and you could see rust on the exposed rebar. The bridge's support beams were a disaster waiting to happen. The same outmoded design had caused a deadly bridge collapse not long before in Minneapolis. And yet Stanley Draper's elevated highway continued to carry its full load of cars. In fact, it carried twice the daily load it had been designed for. Even the grandest projections of the 1960s planners could not keep up with the vehicular fire hose of modern American traffic. Oklahoma's state government was, by this point, unbelievably dysfunctional, and the state's infrastructure was the worst in the nation, and roads and bridges were crumbling everywhere. But the Stanley Draper Expressway was a particularly embarrassing example, an eyesore that ran right past the basketball arena in Bricktown, a torn-up welcome mat at the city's front door. For such a self-conscious city, the once grand road now made a peculiarly bad first impression. And so the Stanley Draper Expressway was being torn down. Interstate 40 had already been relocated 5 blocks south, at a cost of nearly $700 million, a tab picked up, naturally, by the federal government. OKC continued to rely heavily, as it had since the moment of its conception, on federal favors and funds. The old elevated highway's access ramps were blocked off to traffic, and for the first time in nearly 50 years, since the day when Draper himself had ridden at the head of the ceremonial opening procession, the road went quiet. It was the end of an era. It's silly to get sentimental about a road, probably, but people did. Before the demolition began, the city opened the Stanley Draper Expressway one last time for pedestrians to come and pay their respects. People came from all over the city to stand and admire the skyline, to eat lunch on the patchy asphalt, to jog and ride bikes. They left with souvenir chunks of concrete. Then, the destruction began. The road was huge, so the process took many months. All around it, everyone went about their regular business as, day by day, little by little, the town's central monolith came down. Eventually, only the expressway's support pillars remained, looking majestic and forlorn, like the ruins of an ancient temple. The death of the old was, of course, the birth of the new. An opportunity for another of Oklahoma City's grand plans. For the first time in generations, downtown was no longer bisected by an elevated highway. The core of the city could be fundamentally reimagined. What would rush in to fill that void? What could possibly replace Stanley Draper's namesake road? The answer was a new road, a better road, a road of the future. The Oklahoma City Boulevard. Officials described it as a new front door to the city. "We intend to make it," Mayor Mick said, "the grandest street this generation has ever seen." Residents began to imagine something sophisticated and elegant, a sort of middle American Champs-Élysées, with shops and restaurants and bikes and pedestrians and trees. Perhaps there would be street performers, elaborate fountains, Segway lanes, fruit carts. Times had changed, and the boulevard would reflect that. The new road would be the opposite of the Stanley Draper Expressway, a thriving channel of true public life downtown, a habitat for actual humans instead of cars, a destination, not just a high-speed suburban escape route. And the boulevard would lead, appropriately, right to the new civic temple at the center of OKC, the basketball arena. Game 31. KD is not nice. On New Year's Eve, 2012, in the second quarter of a game against the lowly Phoenix Suns, Russell Westbrook went flying wildly to the basket, into a crowd of enemy hands and elbows, and collapsed. Blood came gushing from his face. Was it serious? It looked serious. Durant said later that there was so much blood, he thought one of the defenders must have had a knife hidden in his jersey. Westbrook rolled around and slapped the floor and cursed, and Thunder trainers escorted their hemorrhaging point guard off to the locker room. It seemed possible that Westbrook might, for the first time in his whole reckless life, actually be injured. Oklahoma City had never really known basketball without the central chaos of Westbrook. What would rush in to fill that void? How would Durant respond? Might a lack of Westbrook actually bring stability? Was Russell Westbrook, strictly speaking, necessary? All of these questions would remain hypothetical, because minutes later, Westbrook came charging back out of the locker room, up the tunnel and onto the floor, riding a frenzy of maniacal anger, with 8 stitches next to his eye. In only a few minutes, he managed to pour in a full night's worth of points, turning the game in the Thunder's favor. OKC walked off with an easy win. Once again, the gods of destruction had been unable to take Russell Westbrook down. It seemed more likely that someday, in the end, he would find a way to take them down instead. This is how 2012 ended. The Thunder entered the new year with the best record in the NBA, 24-6, having won 15 of their previous 17 games. They were blowing teams out, often without even appearing to try. Their biggest alleged rivals in the West, the star-studded Lakers, were imploding under the stresses of injuries and arguments. The Thunder's path back to the finals seemed clear. The new year, 2013, sounded like the future, odd and angular, not quite real. And that future would belong to Oklahoma City. The first game of the new year came at home, where the Thunder were particularly dominant. They had won 12 straight in front of their invariably sold-out crowd. The visitors were the mediocre Brooklyn Nets. There was no reason to doubt that this would be consecutive home win number 13. Instead, right from the start, the game was a disaster. The Nets, somehow, looked like a pack of full moon teen wolves, and the OKC crowd was shocked into silence. At halftime, the Thunder were losing by 23. "God, we're getting our asses destroyed by the Brooklyn Nets," wrote a commenter on Daily Thunder. Another added that it was the worst half of the season, and another escalated even further to say that it was the worst game since 2009. And although those statements were harsh, they might actually have been true. What was the problem? Well, there were several. Although the Thunder were very good, they were still imperfect, and this Nets game was exposing the team's flaws to an almost comic degree. Westbrook was a tumbleweed in a hurricane. Forcing shots, blowing defensive rotations, missing layups, and occasionally dribbling the ball directly into his defender's arms. Although Kevin Martin was, in many ways, an effective Harden replacement, he lacked Harden's funky creative skills, and sometimes the whole offense suffered for it. The centers were slow, with hands made of lunch meat. The coaching staff did not seem imaginative enough to compensate for these deficiencies. The team's most confounding problem, however, and one the commenters were allowing themselves to harp on more and more these days, was the curious passivity of Kevin Durant. It was that old familiar curse blessing. KD was nice. Nearly halfway through the season, he was still conducting his strange experiment in altruistic ball sharing. He had even taken to dribbling up the court himself, initiating the offense, acting like a de facto point guard. An odd and often ineffective strategy. It was hard to be mad at Durant, of course, the superstar with the heart of gold, and yet it was also frustrating. Durant had this problem where he liked to throw hypothetically good passes, regardless of real-world conditions. They were an idea of a good pass instead of the thing itself. They were superego passes, and most fans just wanted to see him score with his id. During that disastrous first half against the Nets, as the game slipped away, Durant hardly shot at all. At halftime, a Daily Thunder commenter clacked a tender wish out of his keyboard into the universe. "I want to see KD rage in the second half," he wrote. "I rarely ever see him rage." This wish, improbably, was about to come true, although almost certainly not in the way the commenter had intended. In the second half, the Thunder started to chip away at the Nets' huge lead, and the crowd unmuted itself and urged them on. In the middle of the fourth quarter, Kevin Martin took a pass from Thabo Sefolosha and hit a deep three-pointer, tying the game, sending the fans into relieved jubilations. To come back and win this game after such a shameful first half would be like a resurrection, the kind of miracle a championship team pulled off. In that moment, everybody looked to Kevin Durant. The end of a tied game, momentum seized, home fans euphoric. This was the natural habitat of an NBA scoring champion. But KD, for whatever reason, could not take over that night. He missed a three. He fumbled the ball away. He committed a foul. He missed another shot, committed another foul, missed a layup. The game fell apart. The whole team followed Durant's lead, turning into a sloppy, inaccurate, fouling mess. Almost in spite of themselves, the lowly Nets ran away with the game. Finally, Kevin Durant couldn't take it anymore. With 2 minutes left, and the game out of reach, after all those saintly years of peace, he allowed the people to see him rage. The referee called an offensive foul, obvious and accurate, on Kendrick Perkins. This set Durant off. He shouted something at the ref and flung one of his exorbitantly long arms. The referee blew his whistle. Technical foul. This meant another free throw for the Nets, which would put the game even further out of reach. But Durant still wasn't done. He continued to yell, now with such foul-mouthed venom, that the referee blew his whistle again. A second technical. Automatic ejection. The people were stunned. This was brand new territory, the first ejection of Durant's career. It was like seeing the statue at the Lincoln Memorial stand up from its chair and start pushing schoolchildren down the front steps. Even then, Durant wasn't done. As he walked off the court, scowling, exiled, as the TV cameras zoomed in, as the viewers at home stared in disbelief, Kevin Durant turned to the referee and said, with an unholy sneer, "Fuck you." There was no mistaking it. His lips practically read themselves. Online, the commenters went bananas. Someone posted the word LOL approximately 400 times in a row. "Baby Kevin has grown up," they said. "I feel so proud right now," wrote someone else. Inside Chesapeake Arena, the crowd produced a thick tide of boos, an unusual, almost unprecedented sound from Thunder fans. Many stayed, even after the game was over, to boo the referees off the floor. In the locker room, a reporter asked Durant what he had said to the referee. "I said it was a bad call," Durant told him. But we had seen what he had said, and that was not it. A few nights before Durant's ejection, I'd happened to be roaming the outskirts of Bricktown when I saw a billboard that stopped me cold. It was way out next to the route of the newly relocated I-40, where the image would presumably harvest the most possible vehicular eyes. And I walked into a dark, scrubby field and stared up at it for a long time. The billboard featured a picture of Durant, 20 feet tall, larger even than his largeness in life. He was wearing his Thunder uniform and unleashing a primal scream. The caption, adorned with a Nike swoosh, said, "KD is not nice." Alone in the field, I laughed out loud. This was a bold piece of counter-programming. The campaign would soon go nationwide, appearing on t-shirts and in TV commercials, in magazine spreads and Foot Locker window displays. Leading the league and scoring 3 years straight is not nice, the ad said. Making defenders famous in all the wrong ways is not nice. Dropping 30 points before anyone realizes what's hit them is not nice. Nailing three-pointers from way beyond the arc is not nice. Durant's entourage started wearing KD is not nice shirts around town. Nike's muddying of the moral waters was a naked commercial ploy, but it also seemed to reflect something brewing deep in the psyche of the man himself. Anyone watching Durant that season would have already noticed small signs of strain. His first ejection did not come out of nowhere. The Thunder's finals appearance the previous summer had launched Durant to a whole new level of superstardom, and he seemed to be struggling a bit with the extra attention. The Thunder's PR handlers were spending much of their time keeping people away from their superstar, denying interview requests, trying to maintain some small bubble of normalcy. Even they were shocked by the degree of attention. Durant's two technical fouls against the Nets gave him 5 on a season that was not even halfway over, a far higher rate of misbehavior than he'd ever shown before. He was one of the league leaders now, up there with such notorious hotheads as DeMarcus Cousins, Larry Sanders, and Russell Westbrook himself. As January dragged on, not niceness seemed to spread through the Thunder like ink in water. Local radio reported that Eric Maynor, the backup to the backup point guard, had instigated a blowout argument over playing time with, of all people, Sam Presti. Kendrick Perkins's wife, Vanity, got into an altercation with a nail technician at an Oklahoma City salon, an incident that might not have been terribly newsworthy, except that Kendrick himself rumbled up in his SUV to defend her, cursing out the nail tech and spiking a Gatorade bottle off the shop's front window. Security footage, along with interviews of the salon's employees, played on the evening news. None of this, of course, was part of Presti's process. In the middle of a game in Denver, Russell Westbrook, absurdly, made a villain of himself by leaping up and swatting away, at the very last second, a backward half-court shot by the Nuggets mascot Rocky, a shot that would have won the entire crowd a prize. Nuggets fans booed, and Westbrook paced the floor and muttered at them like a madman, and later in the game he did it again, catching the mascot's shot just before it fell through the hoop. And this time he actually flung the ball out into the crowd, and he didn't smile or laugh, not even slightly. 2 weeks after Kevin Durant's first ever ejection, the TV cameras caught him cursing again. His grandmother sent him a text. "Kev, Kev, stop cussing so much," she wrote. "They be showing you when you do." It was unclear if Durant's grandmother was upset that he was swearing or that the cameras were capturing it, if the problem was one of essence or of perception. "Ha ha, sorry, Grandma," Durant wrote back. "I'd be so emotional. I love you." Before games, as the players warmed up, a new song started to play in heavy rotation on the Chesapeake Energy Arena sound system, an anthem of the defiant underdog called "Started from the Bottom." The players listened to it constantly on their headphones, and they seemed to have taken on its spirit. "Fuck a fake friend. Where your real friends at?" The curse words were bleeped out in public, of course, but it was impossible not to infer them. The attitude of the Thunder seemed to be shifting from universally beloved Pollyanna sunshine overachievers to something else. Heavy favorites, kings of the hill, struggling against the pressure of expectations. Blessed are the placemakers. After many months of civic anticipation, as work crews continued to hack away at the remnants of the Stanley Draper Expressway, OKC finally unveiled the details of its plan for the Oklahoma City Boulevard. Unveiled, actually, is overstating it. The plan came out casually, almost as an afterthought, at a subcommittee meeting about streetcars. Word, however, spread. The grandest street this generation would ever see, it turned out, was not going to be very grand at all. The Oklahoma City Boulevard would not be the charming, cosmopolitan thoroughfare that residents had been encouraged to imagine. In fact, the new road would be a lot like the old road. The engineer's vision was blunt and unromantic, an auxiliary freeway. The boulevard would be 6 lanes wide, designed to carry as many cars as possible, as quickly as possible, between downtown and the new route of Interstate 40. Since traffic would be heavy, the engineers posited, there was no reason to let it mingle with the rest of the traffic downtown. It would need to rise up over the city streets. Which is to say, the city planned to replace the old elevated highway with a new elevated highway. Stanley Draper would have been proud. But Stanley Draper had been dead by then for 35 years, and Oklahoma City was no longer his. The spirit of the place had changed. Powerful men in smoky rooms could no longer plunk freeways down through the center of town. The public had started paying attention. People cared about downtown again. An advocacy group was formed, Friends for a Better Boulevard. Rallies were held. "Don't replace a highway with a highway," said the former planning director of Vancouver to the people of OKC. A PR battle kicked off in the papers and online. The boulevard became a potent metaphor for all that was at stake in modern Oklahoma City. As always, the traffic engineers simply wanted to move traffic. The younger generations, however, wanted something new, a real downtown to live in, a place worth building a collective identity around, not just a bunch of corporate headquarters with parking garages. They wanted to live in a version of Brooklyn, a constellation of funky neighborhoods, each an end in itself, with trees and pedestrians and shops and restaurants. They wanted to walk to grocery stores and sit in parks. In fact, they wanted something closer to the downtown that Stanley Draper had originally stepped into back in 1919. They wanted some of that vital congestion. Similar dynamics were in play in Charlotte and Des Moines and Durham and Indianapolis. The attempt to redeem downtowns from the city planning sins of the 20th century. There were strong echoes of Jane Jacobs versus Robert Moses. In Oklahoma City, signs of young energy were beginning to pop up frequently. A monthly street festival featuring craft beer and gourmet snow cones. A food truck that sold handmade waffles. Excellent coffee shops at which 20-somethings with tattoo sleeves and chunky glasses sat together to collaborate on websites about bike lanes. A buzzword began to circulate in the planning community downtown. Placemaking. In early 2013, a conference called Placemaking drew more than 1,000 people to the University of Oklahoma to listen to experts speak about crosswalks and historic preservation incentives and how to reclaim abandoned suburban malls. The crowd included not only young activists, but many of OKC's established power players, architects, and former mayors and city council members. From the stage, multiple speakers remarked that they'd never seen, in any other city, such a hunger for this discussion. It was, perhaps, a sign of how radically far OKC had gone under Draper and his allies in exactly the opposite direction. The boulevard fight seemed to encapsulate this. After the city's plan got around town, 400 citizens showed up at a public meeting to object. But officials told them it was too late. Promises had already been made. Huge stacks of complex paperwork had been filed. The process had begun. Their hands were tied. Citizens couldn't expect to just waltz in at the last minute with their unofficial emotions and demand an infrastructure revolution. The engineers showed maps and animations demonstrating traffic inefficiencies. "Look at all the cars," they said. What would happen when an accident inevitably shut down I-40? The boulevard would have to be able to handle the overflow. The traffic of the entire continent depended, in a way, on this new road in the middle of Oklahoma City. The placemakers rejected all of this. Many suggested that the city would be better off with nothing in place of the Stanley Draper Expressway. Downtown should revert to its original street grid, they said. Rewind history, start again. Young people didn't want to organize their lives, as their parents had, around cars, freeways, malls, suburbs, distance. If a new boulevard was truly necessary, they argued, it should be narrow and slow. Stop designing the city around peak traffic volume, which was only 2 hours every weekday. Think of all the other parts of life. The city council, however, sided with the engineers. The boulevard, they insisted, had to be wide, high, fast, and open no later than 2014. The new I-40 didn't have enough exits because it had been designed with the expectation of an elevated boulevard to supplement it. And downtown drivers were already suffering from the lack of them. Further discussion was just a waste of everyone's time. And so in January 2013, 5 days after Kevin Durant's first career ejection, the city council voted 7-2 to send the boulevard design to the state for implementation. The Oklahoma City Boulevard would be an elevated pseudo-freeway. As a concession to the placemakers, it would be slightly shorter than it had originally been drawn up, but that was it. After the vote, the council congratulated itself on its flexibility. It was, one member said, the beginning of new politics and new policymaking in OKC. Still, the people would not quiet down. A city manager holds a strange position in American civic life. He or she is an unelected, quasi-governmental official, often referred to as the CEO of the city. The city manager's job is to get things done. While the mayor handles vision, and the city council processes legislation, the city manager takes care of logistics, traffic patterns, construction schedules, tax revenues. The position was created in the early 20th century as an attempt to extract the nuts and bolts of a functioning city from the hurly-burly of politics. The city of Oklahoma City's city manager was a no-nonsense engineer named Jim Couch. By 2013, when the boulevard issue was simmering toward a rolling boil, Couch had held the position for 13 years. This made him a force of unprecedented stability. In the 73 years preceding Couch, OKC had run through 34 city managers, with one lasting only 2 days. Couch was a professional's professional, able to get even the most complex projects done on schedule and on budget. He was a process man, and he'd been instrumental in the downtown renaissance, helping to enable not only the acquisition of the Seattle Supersonics, but the reawakening of the once dry river and the 800-foot skyscraper that rose out of an old parking lot. Couch had presided over the revivals of Bricktown, Midtown, the Plaza District, and Automobile Alley. He understood, on a deep level, what made the city of Oklahoma City run. He knew how to work all the levers and cranks and valves back in the engine room. Although he was not nearly as well known as the mayor, Jim Couch was arguably more influential. One afternoon, in the midst of the boulevard controversy, I went to speak with Couch in his office in City Hall. I arrived to find him upset. The Wall Street Journal had just published an article, Couch told me, about Aubrey McClendon, one of OKC's most powerful citizens, the Thunder co-owner and fracking legend who had recently been forced to resign from Chesapeake Energy after getting caught in some shady land deals. The article, Couch said, was an obvious hit piece. But he seemed to be most fixated on a small detail in it that had nothing to do with McClendon at all. The reporter, Couch said, had come to his office just like me. In fact, he'd sat on the very same couch that I was sitting on now. And then he had had the gall to publish the following sentence. A framed team jersey, autographed by the players, hangs on the wood paneling of his office. Couch was furious about this mention of his wood paneling. What relevance, he asked me, could that detail possibly have had to a story about Aubrey McClendon? How was the wood paneling in his office in any way germane? I spoke up on behalf of journalism to say that sometimes it's important to set the scene, and small details help us do that, and the prominence of that basketball jersey on the office wall spoke to Couch's close relationship to the Thunder, and therefore, by extension, the entire city's relationship to the team. Couch waved this explanation away. I just don't see how it was germane to the subject, he said. wood paneling. As we talked, I could not help noticing that Couch was standing in precisely the scene the Wall Street Journal reporter had described. A Thunder jersey, framed and signed, hung on a wall that was, beyond any possibility of debate, wood-paneled. Couch was complaining about the description of his wood-paneled wall directly in front of his wood-paneled wall. I looked back and forth, from him to it, feeling slightly confused. The description struck me as not controversial in the least. Couch, however, wouldn't let it go. "I just don't see how it was germane," he said. I had come to talk to Couch not about wood paneling, but about city planning. The placemakers, the pros and cons of the various proposed boulevard designs, the controversy, the challenges and opportunities of running a city with an increasingly engaged, increasingly progressive, increasingly planning-conscious young citizenry. "I've heard a lot of talk about this boulevard issue," I began. "Really?" Couch answered. He seemed stunned, as if I had told him that everyone around the nation was talking about his favorite flavor of toothpaste. "Yeah," I said. "To me, that's kind of a non-issue," Couch said. "Really?" I said. Now I was surprised. "Yeah," he said. "Well, some people got pretty upset about it, it seemed like," I said. "Yeah," he said. "Yeah," I said. "It's kind of a non-issue," he said. "Really?" I said. "Yeah," he said. That was how the conversation went. Couch walked me over to a big map on his wall. The utopian fantasy of the boulevard, he explained, was based on a complete misunderstanding. The old elevated highway, he stabbed at the map with his finger, had been pulled down and moved south. This was great, because it meant there was no longer an elevated highway running right through the middle of downtown. But its absence created a problem too, because now it was inconvenient for highway drivers to get downtown. This, in Couch's view, was the main difficulty the boulevard had to solve. The project was huge and complicated, he explained, with 5 separate phases, and people were getting fixated, for no good reason, on this one tiny piece, Phase 3. He pointed to the spot on the map where some streets intersected. "This is a disaster right here," he said. "It's a disaster. The highway department in the original plan said, we're just going to go over the top of all that stuff. We won't touch it. We'll just go over the top of it and have a bridge over there." People said, "Well, wait a minute, you just took that bridge down. How come you're building a new bridge?" "Well, because we've got a horrendous traffic problem over here. You don't want to put lights all the way through here and have it degrade. The boulevard won't be functional. You won't be able to get people in and out of downtown to the interstate." Couch seemed genuinely proud of Oklahoma City's ability to move cars. "We don't have traffic problems," he said. He was a Thunder superfan, a season ticket holder, and he often thought about downtown planning in terms of how easily he could drive himself from the arena back to his suburban home after a game. Just the night before, Couch said, he had watched the Thunder destroy the Golden State Warriors. "I was there, too. At halftime, I had watched Aubrey McClendon dancing, courtside, with wild enthusiasm, to an East Side High School marching band." "I live 12 miles north of here," Couch said, getting excited. "I stayed at the Thunder game until the final buzzer, and I was home by 9:45. I'm talking about getting out of the arena, leaving the parking garage, getting into the downtown traffic, whatever I had to do to get on the interstate, and getting up to my house, which is 12 miles away. I think the buzzer was around 9:25. It took me 20 minutes. It's pretty sweet." The purpose of the boulevard, in Couch's view, was to safeguard the sweetness of that deal, both for him and the other drivers of OKC. "But what about all the opposition?" I asked. Couch minimized it. "It was controversial for a few weeks," he said. "It was really an issue hijacked by a few people on a website, some social media." And then he shook his head. "That's the generation we're in today." I asked him about the activists' hopes that the boulevard might create a new neighborhood on the western edge of downtown. Couch scoffed. "That's the McDonald's and the city rescue mission down there," he said. "The homeless shelter. We're really concerned about the development potential in that area? My planner will tell you that it will be generations before downtown will expand into that area." Who's your planner? I asked.
My planner? Couch said.
The city planner is Russell Klaus. I met Russell Klaus in the old Colcord building, one of OKC's rare historic skyscrapers to survive into the 21st century. The tower that Ralph Ellison's father had helped